Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast teetering on the edge of a precipice. My name's Corey Hazelhurst and my partner and propagandist, Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
Brexit, hey? Bloody hell. The last 2 weeks of British politics have been, too eventful to talk about all in one podcast, Steve, but not quite seismic enough to warrant us recording an emergency podcast. But now we know that you, dear listener, you've been waiting patiently for our predictions, mainly so that you can hear what we think is going to happen and then assume the opposite will happen. But God knows what will happen now. All we can do in this episode is say what we know has happened and also then say things that we think will happen and we'll go from there. And I promise I won't cry. So, Steve, the first thing we know is that there's been a withdrawal agreement negotiated between the UK and the EU. And very, very briefly, now I'm going to try and summarise that in about 30 seconds without you falling asleep. But basically, that withdrawal agreement gives EU, and I'm going from the Institute of Government summary, I can't honestly claim to have read the withdrawal agreement, but it's fine, neither does anyone else. But apparently, so essentially, it gives EU law supremacy over UK law. In the withdrawal agreement in March, there was just that supremacy in terms of citizens' rights. But in this November agreement, that supremacy has been given for all EU law. It also puts us in a Turkey-style relationship with the EU, not the Christmas Turkey, but the country Turkey, in which we are essentially part of a customs union with the EU. We sign up to all of the EU trade agreements, but we have no say in actually formulating those agreements. The transition period, or as Theresa May insists on calling it, the implementation period, lasts until December 2020. And if we want to extend that, then we have to pay more money, which will make Peter Bone very happy. There will apparently be some sort of joint committee to resolve disputes between Britain and the EU. Geographical indicators are still protected, so you can still buy Parma ham after Brexit. I was a bit worried about that. And Melton Mowbray pork pies.
I didn't even realise that was up for debate.
Well, I suppose I'm guessing it's so you can't have chlorinated Parma ham coming in from America pretending it's Parma ham when it's not. There is also some agreement on Gibraltar, apparently not good enough to please the Spanish, but it's there. Essentially, Steve, is this what people voted for?
Probably not, is the short answer. The reality here is that I think the withdrawal agreement doesn't really please anybody. So if we break it down by the different kind of groups that are going to be looking at this, Remainers are obviously looking at this and kind of going, we're still staying very closely aligned to the EU's orbit, but we're losing all say in how the rules are shaped. Previously, the kind of like the distinction between a rule taker and a rule maker has been used as part of the kind of like the Brexit debate. And in this instance, this withdrawal agreement would absolutely make Britain a rule taker and not a rule maker in any form. So Remainers, not happy. In terms of the ERG and the Brexiteers, well, they are also not happy because the withdrawal agreement leaves Britain very closely aligned to the EU in a number of key areas. I mean, you mentioned the fact that we're going to have a kind of a Turkish-style customs union with the EU, which, again, means we are going to lose the ability to set our own independent trade policy, which does have the distinct advantage, which means let's give him his full title, disgraced former Defence Secretary Dr. Liam Fox, who somehow is still in government, has basically not got a real job, despite being a Secretary of State for International Trade. So, and for Brexiters, at least for a lot of the Tory Brexiters, one of their big kind of themes has been the notion of sovereignty relaying into trade as a kind of a relaunching of the British buccaneering mercantilist spirit, going out into the world and striking trade deals left, right and centre so that we can impart our knowledge and the world's goods can come flowing back to the UK. In reality, that's, of course, complete and utter crap. But that's the delusion that an awful lot of the Brexiteers seem to have. And this withdrawal agreement kills that off stone dead, which means you can't actually get anywhere with what they want. So they're not happy. The only people who might actually be happy with this are, I think, your average Leave voter. The reality is, most the campaign, for the Brexit campaign, was not won on sovereignty, necessarily. It was not won on trade negotiations and the ability to strike free trade deals. It was won on immigration. The polls only flipped in Leave's favour when immigration became the main kind of focus of the Brexit, of the Leave campaign. And one of the major things that Theresa May has done is basically got Britain opted out of pretty much all freedom of movement from the European Union, which from the perspective of the economy is interesting, to say the least, but from the political perspective of this is what people care about, this is why people voted to leave, and that is clearly the gamble that Theresa May is taking, is that she thinks this is why people voted to leave. It gives her something to crow about. It gives her something to say, look, we have secured this major, major thing, which is what you all were complaining about to begin with.
So I think what we have is, this is the reality of Brexit. And the reality of Brexit is you either have a soft Brexit in which you have that lack of control. As you say, it's the you don't have you have to adhere to the rules but have no say in how they're being made. And the fact that Britain, the fact that May's red lines have meant that Britain had, she says we're going to believe in the single market and the customs union, means she's not been able to join bodies like the EEA or EFTA, which might still enable Britain to have some say in how those laws are formulated. And that's a problem. The alternative to that is you have the hard Brexit, which means you have the economic catastrophe. Now, I slightly take issue with what you've said about immigration. I mean, you're right, immigration was a massive reason why people voted Leave, as was sovereignty, to be fair. Sovereignty and immigration are the two main reasons why.
I think sovereignty and immigration are the same thing in that instance. I think a lot of people, when they're talking about sovereignty, they either mean the ability to stop people coming over here rather than stopping the EU set our bendy banana rules.
Well, you know? In terms of Leave voters who were polled after the referendum, what they said was that that sovereignty and immigration were the two main reasons. I think it's sovereignty in terms of that. We can set our own trade deals. And even in terms of actually the Brexit campaign, it was, and there were quite a few ethnic minority voters who voted Leave because they bought a lot of the rhetoric of people like Priti Patel, who said, OK, well, if we, rather than having immigrants come in from the EU, we can prioritise, say, curry chefs coming over from India and from Asia to come in. So there's a part of that as well. But what polls have also suggested since the referendum is actually people prioritise access to the single market and prioritise basically keeping Britain's economy afloat over restricting immigration. So I think you're right in that May is, it's very clear she's saying that she's honouring the will of the British people. However, I'm not really sure this deal does that.
I mean, this is one of those the classic scenarios you have when you come to a referendum, especially when it's a referendum, which is an open-ended question, which is what we had. It was like, do you want to leave the EU? Yes or no. And then what? We didn't have that follow-up question. And at least that follow-up question was not asked directly to the British people. And even the opportunity to dictate that indirectly in the 2017 general election, Brexit wasn't a massive talking point in any format. So there is no real way actually to say one way or another what the will of the British people is at this point in time. Yes, we do have polling. Yes, we can do analysis. Yes, we can look at these things and go on gut instinct in this, that and the other. And everybody's doing that.
It's almost like we should have another vote, a people's vote, you might say. So we know what's in that withdrawal agreement, even though we haven't read it. Second thing we know is that two cabinet ministers resigned as a result of that withdrawal agreement. One of them was Esther McVeigh, because she wants to be Prime Minister. The other one who resigned was Dominic Raab. Now, Dominic Raab, of course, was the Brexit Secretary responsible for negotiating this agreement. And he came out on the radio, I think yesterday, saying that the agreement, basically, that he negotiated was worse than actually the deal we have from staying in the EU. which says a lot about the talents of Dominic Raab.
Actually, this is one of the few times I think I will say this. I think people are actually being slightly unfair to Dominic Raab here, because as funny as that kind of that image of, you know, somebody negotiating a deal and then resigning over the deal they've negotiated is, the reality is, quite early on into Dominic Raab's kind of like career, however you want to put it, as Brexit secretary, Theresa May took all the power for the negotiations. Dominic Raab's role has just been preparing for no deal,
which he's done stormingly well.
Absolutely, yeah. I'm not saying he hasn't been bad crap at his job in other ways, but really, like, this is Theresa May's deal. This is Oliver Robbins' deal. This has got nothing to do at this stage with the Brexiters, which is really one of the things that's kind of really getting under their skin, because they feel like they haven't been given the opportunity to actually argue their to negotiate in the way that they wanted to, which is completely farcical given that David Davis was the Brexit secretary for years.
Davis, Johnson, Fox, then Raab, all in cabinet, all have responsibility for negotiating this mess. All have worked out that the stuff that they promised everyone just didn't exist. It's a mirage of unicorns and three-humped camels. And rather than deal with that, and rather than say, come to some sort of compromise, or say, like, we should join the EEA because that would honour the result of the referendum but not destroy the British economy, or say, actually, this is stupid, we should try and call the whole thing off. Instead, they've just retreated into fantasy. Some of them, maybe because they are just, well, either some like Johnson, because they want to be Prime Minister and have no scruples. Some because, I suppose, admitting that you're wrong is very, very hard. But either way, it means you're left. They've left it to the civil service, and they've left it to Theresa May, because they're the only ones who have bothered to come up with a concrete solution. And to be fair, May has come up with a concrete solution. It's just, when you look at the red lines that she set herself, she boxed herself into an impossible position where there is no good deal.
Absolutely. After the the Lancaster House speech, where she kind of outlined the red lines for the Brexit negotiations. After that speech, I think it was there was a presentation given by the EU where they effectively outlined all the different relationships that existed between the different trading partners that they had, including like full EU membership, EFTA, EEA, Canada Plus, and all those sorts of things. And they quite literally, on the slide where they were outlining all of this visually, put Theresa May's red lines on there in red and labelled them no freedom of movement, ability to set free trade deals, all of that sort of stuff. And ultimately, it boiled down to Canada and Canada alone. That was the only one that could really actually function with those trade deals. The only issue then, in order to move things forward in a desperate bid to just have something to spin as positive news, the government then signed up for the Irish backstop without thinking it through what any of it meant. And all the people who are now criticising the Irish backstop were hailing it as a massive victory for Brexit, this time last year. It's an absolute joke. These people have been in charge of this in various forms, achieved absolutely nothing. And then when Theresa May has actually pulled her finger out and actually got on with the job, and yes, she's screwed up a lot, yes, she's boxed herself in, but she's actually delivered something, which, to be quite honest, I don't think a lot of people were actually expecting. Whether she can get it through the House is another issue, but she's delivered something.
You're getting ahead of ourselves, Steve, because that's something we think we know, but we don't know yet. Let's talk about what else we know. So we talked about the two ministers that resigned. We also know that Michael Gove nearly resigned, but didn't. And I think if Michael Gove had resigned, A, it would have been hilarious, because he would have then stabbed Cameron and Boris and Theresa May in the back. And maybe almost on that level, it was a bit too much for him to completely destroy the career of three Tory leaders or prospective Tory leaders. But the fact that he stayed, I think, meant that it stopped that mass resignations. And so people like Andrea Leadsom, Liam Fox, as you've said.
Penny Mordaunt,
who was the only cabinet minister I said would resign, which tells you something about my predictions. They have stayed in the hope that they're going to renegotiate the deal, which I think means they're going to get an ice cream cornet, put it on the horse's head, and then pretend the horse is a unicorn. What we also know is that the ERG haven't got the numbers to bring down Theresa May, because A week ago, it looked like we were going to have to record an emergency episode because Jacob Rees-Mogg and Steve Baker were trying to launch a coup. Well, they weren't trying. They did launch a coup against Theresa May, and they wanted everyone to put their letters in. And then nobody did. Or rather, 25 people did, but that's not 48 people.
A few months back, on one of our old episodes, we were discussing like the Tory leadership and potential dark horse candidates, because the Tories tend to back dark horses. And I actually said, you know, Steve Baker could be one to watch, because he's a Brexiteer. He's supposed to be really good at organising things. He's in with the ERG, you know, all of these things which could work in his favour. I need to take all of that back now.
I was going to be really nice to you and not mention that.
Yeah, well, I thought I'd bring it up, and, you know, mea culpas and all that. But it is absolutely astounding just how badly the ERG have handled this. I just don't understand how they have been in this position for so long, and they've not actually got anywhere near the actual number. Because for 6 months or so, we've been supposedly teetering on the edge of the 48 letters are in. Is it going to be this week? And turns out, no, they're nowhere near that. And as you say, only 25 of them are in. And it looks like the vast bulk of the ERG are not prepared to actually put their letters in. And that's before you get into the realms of Nadine Dorries, who came out and said, yeah, I've put my letter in, but I don't actually want to topple May.
That having your cake and eat it, I think.
Yes, I think this was a few days direct after she was complaining about the fact that leaving the EU meant we wouldn't have any MEPs.
So now we've said we know that the letters aren't in, now let's try and do a little bit of idle speculation. So we don't know what the true number is.
No, only Graham Brady does.
Only Graham Brady does. And I still hope, my one hope from all this mess is that in 20 years' time he opens a drawer in his study and finds the other letters that were actually sent to him, but he'd lost them. But the ERG itself is around 80 members strong. And to be fair to you, in your earlier prediction, Steve Baker is very, very good at organising these MPs to vote to sabotage various government bits of legislation and to amend various government bits of legislation. So we've talked about that in the summer, about how key things like the wording of the question, the fact that there was going to be a perda period in the referendum, is really significant. And Steve Baker was the ringleader of that. And he can probably get a lot of Tory backbenchers to put a lot of pressure on the government to do that. But what's also clear is that is not a group of 80 MPs that will do anything that he says. And what seems to have happened here is a lot of the kind of older, presumably calmer heads, like Michael Fabricant, and I cannot believe I've had to say that sentence, have come out. And it seems people like Michael Fabricant, I think Bernard Jenkin as well, were saying that they weren't going to put their letters in. And what also seems to have happened is Steve Baker said something to the effect of, MPs said that they put letters in, and it turns out they hadn't, and they said that they had done something that they hadn't actually done. And I cannot believe that politicians were so duplicitous in that way. That's not the politics I know and love, Steve. I don't want to see random.
If you can't trust a politician, then who can you trust, really?
But so what it seems to me has happened is that people have written letters and then withdrawn them. That seems to me what's happened. Or maybe have sent them in, but they only want them to be triggered at a certain point, maybe when the threshold's already reached. That presumably is what happened, is that they've taken the total of everyone they think has sent a letter in, but not all of them are counting yet. And so they've grossly overplayed their hand.
This falls down at the feet of the ERG leadership as to how everything has gone belly up for them. They have overplayed their hands, absolutely. And the reality is, even if tomorrow it suddenly turned out, here's all those 48 letters, they're all in, Theresa May's not losing that vote of no confidence.
We think we know that.
They can't organise themselves to do anything. And I think if they can't even organise 48 letters, how the hell are they going to organise and be the ringleaders of a mass vote of Conservative Party MPs, of which they need a majority to basically pass that vote of no confidence in May? No, I think one of the kind of the biggest issues, though, the ERGs had, though, is that, and I suspect this may be why the likes of Fabricant and Jenkin haven't put in their letters and are not at this stage going to, is because there is no obvious successor. We've gone back to that core issue of how Theresa May is still in post. It's because there is no one that's an obvious candidate to take over the job. At various points, different Brexiteer individuals have kind of been built up, but then they faded away. Originally, it was Johnson. Nowhere near anymore. His leadership chances are probably completely scuppered by now. Then it was Jacob Rees-Mogg, but then we reached peak Mogg, and now suddenly no one cares and wants to listen to him anymore.
Now it's Dominic Raab who's zooming up the betting stakes.
But
maybe Beto O'Rourke should be the next Prime Minister.
but yeah, I think there is a... Because they have not been able to find a potential candidate, or even just a potential stalking horse to front everything, they've just failed to make the case to anybody. And I think the reason that they failed to find a stalking horse is because everybody knows that May is in a weak position, and everybody's going, well, I might be able to win. And everyone knows that the assassin never gets becomes the king. So ultimately, I think their own internal politicking may have damaged themselves and their opportunity to get rid of May.
And you get the impression that people think Steve Baker and Jacob Rees-Mogg have got a little bit too big for their boots. I think there was one unnamed Tory MP who said that Steve Baker was basically strutting around thinking he was a statesman. And I think there was a little bit of a desire to take them down a peg or two. Which is obviously something, one of the few issues in which Tory MPs, and I'd say about 80% of the public, are completely aligned. Before we finish talking about the ERG and their coup, what I do want to do is defend Dan's army. I feel that Captain Mannering's got a pretty bad deal from the British political press this week, because Jacob Rees-Mogg was basically asked if he thought that their operations seemed like some sort of Dad's army style farce. And he delighted the press by agreeing with them and saying that he'd always been an admirer of Captain Mannering. Now, the thing with Dad's Army, Steve, is that although Dad's Army came across as old and as clueless and as complete buffers, they did win in the end. Now, spoilers if you haven't seen Dad's Army, but in episodes like The Deadly Attachment, yes, okay, the Germans get away, but eventually they get rounded up and outwitted by the platoon. The whole point of Dad's Army is that although they seem amiable and blundering, they just about get it together in the end. This is not what the ERG have done. They are worse than Dad's Army.
Yeah, absolutely. The ERG have... they've barely held it together, let alone getting it together in the end at all. So I think... you know, in some ways, you are quite right there.
Okay, so we know then also that ERG haven't got the letters in. The other thing that we know is the political declaration that's gone in. Now, originally, I think this was 7 pages. It's now 26 pages long, and it's confidential. Now, what confidential means, Steve, is it's been leaked to literally every politician and journalist in Europe. And again, I'm going to try and summarise that in about 30 seconds. In terms of goods, it wants as close as possible a trading relationship, which is not frictionless trade, which is a little bit of a meh, and also envisages a free trade area. In terms of services, it talks about maybe negotiating individual services in a big free term agreement, which is essentially the Whiz Bank Canada deal that we all hear about. Britain will be a normal third country, get the normal third country treatment on financial services, so the city's going to be hilariously pleased with that.
Say goodbye to passporting.
We're going to leave the common fisheries policy and get a new agreement by July 2020, which is going to be a bit of a sticking point, I think, especially with Scottish Tory MPs, where that's really important, and a lot of Brexiters as well, who want Britain to take control of its waters so that only British people can fish for British fish, because of course fish have passports and nationalities as well now. It again talks about geographical indicators, so Melton Mowbray pork pies will be safe in this post-Brexit dystopia in which we're going to live in. Freedom of movement will be ended, but essentially they want to aim to provide visa-free travel, however that happens, and basically have a whole list of opt-outs for researchers, trainers, which is essentially apparently similar to the relationship we currently have with Australia. And I, in many ways, actually, most significant is in crime, where we'd have no access to the European arrest warrant, no access to the European criminal record information system, which we helped set up and fund, and would surely be massively detrimental to actually finding and catching criminals. Then also, again, this is from the Institute for Government, say that there would be some sort of association agreement, basically like a Ukraine-style arrangement. So we've kind of got Turkey on one side and we've got Ukraine on the other. And that apparently the EU is open to UK participation in the European Parliament in certain conditions. Maybe we just make the Dean Dorries our only MEP. I don't know. So that's what we know, and that is going to all be negotiated in 19 months, because, of course, it's been really easy negotiating this bit.
And that's if May survives, because this has still got to get through Parliament, and if it doesn't get through Parliament, then May can't survive.
Okay, so let's go. Let's go to the speculation-y bit. This is all the stuff that we know. Let's try and idly speculate now. So, what we think we know is that the deal cannot pass Parliament, because at the moment, there are various people who are keeping running totals of Tory MPs who've said they're not going to back the deal. I think The Guardian's doing one. I think BuzzFeed and Alex Wickham is doing it as well. I've seen various totals ranging from 75 Tory backbenchers to 83 to 88 backbenchers who won't vote for it, which means the majority of Tory backbenchers have said they will not vote for the deal as it stands. Now, bearing in mind that even if the DUP vote with the government, which is looking a little bit dodgy, but we'll talk about that in a second, there is no way in merry hell this deal passes, surely.
No, I just do not see how it gets through. It's a simple case of arithmetic. So, and unless something drastically changes and people change their minds, this does not get through. That's not necessarily the same thing as saying this deal does not get through in the long term, because it is entirely possible that, you know, the prospect of no deal sharpens a number of minds later on down the line, and then, you know, early next year we have a second vote on the deal and that gets through. But at this point in time, you know, the government's going to get a bloody nose.
Now, there has been some, I think, attempt at diplomacy, I think, with a few Tory backbenchers. Ian Duncan-Smith and Owen Paterson have been having, I assume it's beer and sandwiches in number 10. And Jerry Hayes, who's a Eurosceptic Tory backbencher, who's not come out against May's deal publicly, they've given him a knighthood, which means my question to you, Steve, is what honour would the Prime Minister have to give you to vote for this deal?
To be honest, it would probably be full on like membership of the Lords in some capacity.
Like, would it be Baron Steve of Wheelie Castle?
Probably.
Yeah, I would go probably a baronetcy. As you say though, the reason why we think that this deal won't fail is because we assume that Labour MPs will vote against the government, and I think certainly on the first time this bill goes through, I think that's very, very likely. You've even got people like Kate Hoey, who have written articles for Labour List, giving herself essentially political room to vote against the deal. And okay, Kate Hoey is voting against the deal for the same reason the DUP apparently might vote against the deal. But sometimes you can't help people being wrong for the right. Sometimes you can't help people being right for the wrong reasons, can you? Now, what seems to have become a truism in Westminster now is a situation like you've just said, in which the deal is voted down very, very heavily, the pound collapses, everyone runs around screaming, what the hell have we done? Over Christmas and New Year, May puts lipstick on this deal, it comes back again, and then rather than it being a vote before Christmas, we have a vote instead mid-January, at which point Labour MPs panic. And probably Tory MPs panic as well. We've talked already about how Tory Remainers tend to panic and fall back in line. Could well be a situation where the only people who then vote against the deal are those 25 MPs who've put in letters of publicly to May, saying that they'll get rid of May. At which point, you don't need many wavering Labour MPs
to get themselves over the line. And also at that point, what's interesting is that you said we were going to discuss the DUP, and this could actually be quite a nice little segue into that, is that because the DUP have basically said they're not going to vote for this deal, and they've basically stopped supporting the government on financial matters. They've all but basically said if this deal goes through, that's it. Their arrangement is done with the government, which means there is no governing majority. Which puts Labour in a very interesting position then, though it might actually be a lot more feasible for them to actually get a vote of no confidence through the House in some capacity and to call a general election. And it may very well be that if they were to vote against the deal first time round, but then vote for the deal the second time round, you could effectively split up the government. One of two things would happen. The DUP would definitely be going bye-bye, but maybe you've also end up with the ERG or parts of the ERG buggering off to UKIP or their own little group, which is also something that's been talked up by backbench Tory MPs, anonymously to journalists currently, but at which point the Tories just cannot govern at all. And then one of two things happen. Either May falls to a vote of no confidence and we have a general election, or May just can't do anything anyway, in which case the Labour are laughing, and they just need to wait for a general election to happen.
The other thing we think we know is that the DUP essentially has abandoned the government, and although they haven't quite literally ripped up the confidence and supply yet, it's probably safe to say it's been wiped on their backsides.
Yeah.
And they did vote against the government on some finance bills, and this blindsided Labour whips because the government only won by 5, but there were about 20 or 30 Labour MPs who weren't voting then. But it feels to me like a lot of people, that the consensus now is that this vote goes through second time, which means the consensus is wrong. What you've kind of hinted at is we don't know what happens and what the repercussions will be of the vote of the deal. And if that deal is voted down massively, then what May hasn't refused resigning, Labour will definitely call a vote of confidence. Does the government survive that? Do the DUP eventually go back in the end? Do you have any Labour MPs who vote with the government, which would be hilariously terrible? And then essentially, if we do have that vote of no confidence, essentially, and the government falls, you have 2 weeks to form a new government. Well, if May can't, do you then end up with a Labour minority government?
Yeah, and the other thing is, so much of the kind of the this deal will get through eventually scenario is predicated on the notion that there'll be some kind of economic, slide, the pound will crash or whatever. But if everybody is acting like, actually, this thing is going to get through in the end anyway, that becomes hedged into the assertions of the market, which means you don't get that crash, or it's not as stark, which means do you have the evidence, quote unquote, to show how bad a no deal is, which is what the impetus for getting this deal through is supposed to be. And if you don't get that crash, because people are just assuming this is going to get through, maybe the deal doesn't get through because the MPs aren't being scared enough into doing it. There's so many different potential things that can interplay with each other on this, and no one is going to be able to predict how this goes. You may get bits of it right, but I suspect what you'll find is that some people may get the overall call right, either goes through or it doesn't, but they're not going to get the exactly how we get there correct. Because there's just too many moving pieces for anybody sensible to make a stab at a meaningful prediction.
So the final thing that we know, and it's kind of related to that, I think, is that one of the other truisms which has been talked about now is that there's no majority in the House of Commons for no deal. I think Amber Rudd has mentioned this. I think another couple of Labour MPs have been mentioning this as well, if not in public, then at least privately. And again, this feels like a truism of the consensus in Westminster, which could well end up turning out to be wrong, because there needs to be a majority for something. This is a bit like saying that starvation is not an option. There's no majority for starving, but if we weren't then to eat until March the 29th, we would starve. If nothing happens and nothing is agreed, then we leave without a deal and there's utter, utter chaos. And at the moment, the issue is that there is no majority in the House of Commons for anything. Okay, there's no majority for no deal, but there is no majority at the moment for extending Article 50. There is no majority yet for another referendum, though maybe that's shifting. There's no majority yet to just join EEA or EFTA, even temporarily. There's no majority for May's deal. There's no majority for just stopping the whole thing altogether. So it feels to me, almost, we could be end up sleepwalking. I know Chris Clark has written his book, The Sleepwalkers, on the causes of World War I. And what he says is essentially that people sleptwalk into it, that people were blind to the horrors that we're going to inflict. Don't really want to compare Brexit to the First World War. But I think there's a similar dynamic going on. No one really wants this to happen, but everyone is being quite complacent about that. And to be fair, I think I've been quite complacent on this podcast. I've talked about, oh, well, there'd be some sort of fudge at the end. And you've even got people now saying, oh, well, all, I think Jeremy Corbyn was saying something similar, all EU deals go down to the last minute anyway. And David Davis has said that as well. But you still need to agree something, and nothing is agreed yet.
Yeah, ultimately, you know, anybody who's saying, oh yeah, but there's no majority for no deal, they're talking crap, because it doesn't matter that there's no majority for no deal. What matters is there's no majority for anything else, as you just said. And until something changes, and God knows what that could be, as long as the parliamentary arithmetic stays the same, come next year, there's a deadline. And if we don't have anything set up on that deadline, we leave with no deal. That is written into British law, not just in terms of like the EU, our relationship with the EU, but within British law as well. Like, there was an entire thing about that being put into like a bill, like this time last year.
I'd forgotten that.
Yeah, like in order for us to not leave on that day, not only do we need to get an extension from the EU in some form, which is probably more feasible, I actually think, we would also need to amend legislation to remove the specified date of Brexit in British law. And God only knows if there's the votes for that. It's just an absolute mess.
I should have known that this podcast would end with me rocking in the corner from side to side.
It's a Brexit podcast, of course.
Weeping silently. I think, though, we've done quite a good job at not trying to predict anything apart from that May's deal falls, which means
it will probably go through first time,
which would be hilarious and yet really terrible. If you want to hear more about us, we are on Twitter at NoChampagnePod. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/NotEnoughChampagne. On our website, it's notenoughchampagne.com. James Cram designed our logo. You can follow him on Twitter at James Cram. And Dave Depp is responsible for our theme tune, Plucky Good Times. I'm at Paperback Rioter.
I'm at Acoustic Radical.
Happy plotting, everyone, especially Julian Smith.